Thank you, Rubel, for that verbalizing of the video and the snapshot and the portrait. That's a very challenging way of presenting it, and I'm thankful for that. I'm aware of that awareness of Jesus, of who he was, where he came from, and where he was going, and that and that alone will allow you to suffer or to serve. Until you know who you are, where you came from, and where you're going, you will not be able to serve other people, and you will not be able to suffer. But because he knew both, all three of those things, he was able then to serve, and he was able to go on and pick up and go to the cross and to suffer. And the same thing will be true with us. We will not be able to do either until we are aware of that. Well, I think we probably have explored much of this in enough detail that we're aware and are going to go home tonight or tomorrow very conscious. But that's all right. Repetition is the mother of learning, and it hasn't been so much repetitive as it has been fleshing out. And I think that this has been, it has dovetailed in a way that I had no idea that it was going to dovetail, and nor did Rubel. Especially when I brought that chart out last night. Do you ever drive by church buildings and different groups and look over at them as they come out of the church building with their Bibles in their hands and wonder, I wonder what they are about, and sometimes look down on them. I wonder what people think when they look at us as we come out of our buildings and they're driving by, if anyone looks at us. I wonder what those people are about. And I wonder what they think of us. And tonight and last night we've looked at what we think of ourselves, and I think we have clarified our thoughts about ourselves enough that we're able to do some projecting. I think we're able to do some definitive projecting of where we want to be, where we need to be. And I believe that some good, healthy thinking has come out of this workshop and will continue to come out. And it must be done. And you must not let others do it for you. I must not let others do it for me. What I want to do tonight, just in this closing session, is to ask the question, what kind of a church do you want to be? You're going to have to answer that question. And it's too simplistic to say, well, we want to be the church that Christ wants us to be. I know that. But what does that mean? How do you flesh that out? And how do you put arms and legs and hands and heart on that? And what are the practical implications, and what are the practical applications and implementation? How do you go about putting it in gear? And I'm going to mention four. One or two of them, you probably don't need me to mention them, but I'll mention them anyway. The first one that I'll mention is a tradition-driven church. And we've said enough tonight and today to know that that's not healthy if we're going to be a tradition-driven church. To be a church with tradition is inescapable. You're going to have traditions. A young man came up to me once, and he out of the Chicago inner city church, and he came up to me and he said, we don't have any traditions in our church. So I said, so that's your tradition, huh? And it kind of took him by surprise. Of course he has a tradition. Their tradition was they didn't have any tradition. There's no way to escape tradition. So that you have it is just a given. It is. It's not whether it's good or bad necessarily. It just is. But the question that we need to ask, and I ask this for some of you who are older, what do you want? And I think for all of us, we would answer it. You say, you mean you really want to know what I want? I want to stay in my comfort zone. That's what I want. Now, if you'll be honest, I think you'll have to say the same thing. I want to stay in my comfort zone. Now, if my comfort zone is also that zone where I feel like I ought to be, that's wonderful. But usually they're not in the same. They're not the same. Not for an enlightened group of men. Those two are not synonymous. We would like to stay in our comfort zone because nobody likes to change. But anyway, that's one of the questions that we're going to have to ask. What we've been in the past or what we are presently. And we've got to decide whether we want to be restorationists or preservationists. Now, every church is peopled by both restorationists, if they're fortunate, and preservationists. There are those who would like to preserve it just like it is. Through a blending of these two, an iron on iron, you're going to come out with the better of each. And if you split, if you divorce, and all the preservationists stay over here and hold to the old path, and all the restorationists go over here without the benefit of these preservationists, it may be easier. It may be more pleasant. But you're going to miss the benefit of the other people. If all the verticals go off and they stay by themselves, and all the horizontals go over here and slide and slip slide around and anything goes, if that's what happens, then you're going to miss the benefit that each can provide the other by the iron on iron, which sometimes gets to the point where you just can't stand it anymore. And so you divorce. And each one of you carries the weakness that you brought into the relationship with you to whatever other relationship you establish outside that, but you lack the benefit of the other's opposition or the other's sharpening or the other's criticism, hopefully loving, but you're going to have to decide whether or not you'll be one or the other. What are we comfortable with? But you have to answer the question then, who is the we you're talking about? Every congregation has to ask that question, well, what are we? What do we want? But you have to define who the we is. Is it the old people? Is that the we? Or is it the young people? Is it the newer generation? What are we comfortable with? Well, what's the we if they are the new generation or the younger ones? What they are comfortable with is not the same thing that the older people are comfortable with. The Boston Church has opted to go with what the younger generation is comfortable with. They have opted for the young people. The traditional churches of Christ, for the most part, and this is a blanket statement of generalization, have opted to go with what the old people are comfortable with. Now that's, I know, is a generalization. Our schools often go with what the older money is comfortable with. And if the old money is uncomfortable with what is being said or done, then they just chop off what is being said or done or try to blend the two together and really sometimes try to hide from the old money what the new younger ones are doing. I'm serious. That's often what happens. And they try to keep the board of directors... Let's change the subject. If you want a combination of the two, if you want a combination, there must be accommodation, there must be negotiation, there must be a common denominator found. We know what is the common denominator between all generations, telling Jesus Christ. He is the common denominator. We know that. He is the foundation under all of it. Would you like a quick, real easy glimpse into what is the visible and most immediate bridge between generations in a congregation? Anybody want to venture? It's music. It's music. There's high church and low church, and there's old church music, there's new church music, and all of this is among us, and it's just as surely as you have the young people getting together and just singing their music, and the old people staying over there and just singing the great songs of the church out of the blue book. You've got two congregations developing, and you've got trouble on your hands. But if you'll each have the grace to sing each other's songs, you'll be surprised at what happens when we sing each other's songs. And I mean in the midst of, after you've sung one of these newer songs written by these newer people, and in the midst of all of that, sing, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow," or "Holy, holy, holy Lord God Almighty." And I never thought I would. I was long in learning that. I was raised on the Blue Book. And my father, Snazzy, would turn over in his grave if he knew some of the songs that I sing now, and that I've actually sung some of the Stamps Baxter songs, God forbid.
Amen.
See? But I went to the college church, from the college church to the church at A&M in College Station, and I learned something there, that the way to maximize the effectiveness of both kinds of songs is to sing them both in the companionship or in the company of the other. And sing one or two of this, and then two or three of this, and then one or two of this. And when you sing all of them in the presence of each other, then each one of us is blended into the other, because we are much of what we sing. In fact, if we would be what we sing, we would be a magnificent body of people. The bridge, the most immediate visible bridge to unity, is in your music. Just remember that, please. Okay, let's not spend more time on tradition or institution-driven, other than to say what we've said. The next possibility is that we will be consumer-driven. If not, if we're not going to do what we want, then there is the need, perhaps, to do what they want. And I mean by that, you'll have to do a demographic study of the area in which the church meets. What do they want? What do they need? And I'll use both of those words. And I don't always know how to differentiate. But I'm talking here about personal, individual needs and wants. But I don't know how to differentiate between needs and wants. Oh, little necessity, oh, little luxury, don't you cry. You will be a necessity by and by. That's... How do you address that, really? What is... Shall we gear our message to meet the needs, wants of those around us? Shall we meet them at their need level? You know, that's got to be addressed. I think the question of whether or not it's a need or a want has to be addressed. But I have no question but what Paul addressed people at their need level. And if you're going to meet people, I believe you must meet them at their need level. He became, finish it for me. Paul said, "I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means gain some." To a Jew, he became a Jew. To a non-Jew, he became a non-Jew. And this was the way he approached things. Was that different from the way Jesus approached them? No, Jesus approached them the same way. Who did he say that needed the doctor? The sick. Now that simply says he was approaching them at a need level. He didn't try to sell snowballs to Eskimos. He didn't try to sell sand dunes to Arabs. You don't sell people. He didn't really pitch his message to the religious people. He had a message for them. But he pitched his message to the people that knew they were sick. He pitched it to the sinners, whether they were religious or irreligious. There were people and there were needs, and he tried to bring his message in tune with the needs of the people. I believe that's a healthy approach. But as far as the needs and the wants, you'll have to address that. But that's one of the options. Will you be consumer-driven? Consumer-driven. Jesus was protected from being driven in that way in an excessive manner in this that you mentioned about his washing the disciples' feet. Do you remember when he went to wash Peter's feet? Peter said, "You're not going to wash my feet." Jesus could have said, "Okay, Peter, all right, okay, just settle down. It's all right, just next." And he could have done that. But he said, "Peter, if I don't wash your feet, you don't have any part with me." And then Peter flip-flopped and said, "Oh, Lord, not my feet only, but my hands and my head." Jesus could have said, "Okay, well, bend over and let me get..." No, Jesus could have been victimized by Simon Peter's wants. And Simon Peter did not know what he needed. Jesus knew what Peter needed. Peter said, "You're not going to wash my feet." He said, "Oh, yes, I am." Peter said, "Then wash my hands and my head too." He said, "Oh, no, I'm not." Jesus, and unless you, if you approach the community to meet the needs of people, unless you know who you are, And unless you know what they need, then you'll become the victim of the wants of the community. You'll become the victim of the wants of people. Because there are always going to be people who say, you're not going to wash my feet. And if the church says, oh, well, okay, don't get upset. Don't leave. We're okay. Just sit back down. Or if they say, well, wash my hands and my head and my feet off. Okay, well, bend over here and let's come on. Then you'll become the victim of these people. So you've got to have some reference point. Jesus knew. And since when does the doctor allow the patient to prescribe the medicine and the treatment? So here we are facing these issues that you're going to have to face as you settle yourself into a community. Will you allow yourself to find your identity in being consumer or prospect driven? Jesus in Luke the 14th chapter was not above weeding people out. Do you know what he said when the crowds were swarming and following him? And he turned around and welcomed them and said he was glad they were there that day, and would they fill out an attendance card? And oh my goodness, he wasn't even hardly nice to them. He just turned around and said, unless you deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me, you can't be my disciple. Unless whoever comes after me and doesn't hate his own father and mother can't be my disciple. That didn't set well with those people. To the Jewish people, he said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. And he could have said it in a little bit more palatable way. That just smacked a little bit of cannibalism. And the Jewish people didn't think highly of cannibalism. Eating blood and eating flesh, it just wasn't very appropriate. But he said it. And after that, what happened? Well, a lot of them didn't go back and walk with him anymore. They just said, I can't take that. And Jesus told his disciples, he gave them a way out. He said, you want to leave too? And Peter said, Lord, where else are we going to go? To whom shall we go? Which simply said that Peter loved the Lord more than he understood him. And he followed Jesus through the back door. He didn't know where else to go. May I simply say that that's where I have been, and that's where I am much of the time. I don't know where else to go. If Jesus of Nazareth is not reality, I don't know what reality is. Haven't a clue. In fact, if Jesus of Nazareth, as far as I'm concerned, is not reality, total reality, there is no such thing as reality. But you'll have to make up your mind. You have to decide whether you're willing to risk offending people in order to provide their needs. Now, if you're not willing to take the stand where Jesus took his stand, then you've got a problem. And in our society, one of those stands that we're going to have to bite the bullet and take for ourselves and those who would follow is the stand regarding affluence, the stand regarding materialism. The only viable opponent or opposition that God has to his job and to his place is mammon. It's money. And I don't know how to handle it. I don't know. Except I have come to this conclusion. He's blessed me. We've done without for years and years, but once your children, you're old as I am, you can understand this. Once your children are out of school, and once they're away from home, then you'll have some money. You won't have any until then, but by the way, you may have a little. And how do you handle that? I remember being in Boston, and we were selling a house up there and sold it and made a good profit. 6 months later, the stock market crashed, and we got out, and I'm sorry for the person that bought the house. I'm sorry, but it wasn't my doing. I didn't know. I just got out, and there it came. But I remember thinking one day, you don't deserve all this. I looked back and saw the river, and I saw the ducks flying, and saw this little old piece of property that wasn't worth much of anything, but up there it was. And I looked and I thought, well, you don't deserve all that. And then I realized, well, what's new? Yeah. Of course I don't deserve it. So I made a covenant with God. I will simply be your depository. And whatever I receive from you in the way of monies or properties or wealth, it's yours. Whenever you want it, it's here on deposit, and it's yours. and just open doors of opportunity for me to, so I can share it. And that's the only thing I know to do with it. I don't know how else to handle it. But this is one of those things that we'll have to, you're going to have to address in the culture in which we live, in the, as we approach the consumer. Perhaps it's going to be culture driven, and maybe that should be discussed here rather than in the one above. Where society as a whole sets the standards. Now there are or there will be churches that will be culture driven, and it's a broader term, where the society as a whole sets the standards, both in worldly ethics or lack of them, and religious ritual and the multiplication thereof. Where relativism reigns, where pluralism plagues us, and a Christ of conviction is politically incorrect, you've got a culture that we're living in where all of these things exist. And to be politically correct, you've almost got to be pluralistic. And Christ becomes an addendum. He becomes an appendage. He becomes one of the other idols upon our mantle, just like the Orientals. They'll just be glad to put Christ up there with the Buddha and with all the rest. If we're not careful, if we're a culture-driven people, we will so reduce the gospel of Christ to where it has no definitive meaning whatsoever. And we become just simply, certainly you're a Christian, you know, you do this or you this or you think, but we're also this and we're this, and there's not any real distinctiveness about being a Christian. And I'm not talking about a distinctiveness of being a member of the church. I'm talking about, is your lifestyle going to be distinctively different from the lifestyle of the world? Will you be a counterculture? If you will not be a counterculture, you will find yourself being driven to the place where practicing homosexuals are endorsed and appointed to leadership. You will find them in the pulpit. If culture is what drives you and determines the boundaries of your definition of yourself, you will find yourself courting militant feminists who are in fact anti-biblical and anti-male. There is a militant femininity, there is a militant feminist movement that is actually revisionist in its agenda. They will revise the Word of God, they will revise the entire revelation, and I say this, I'm not against women's liberation, but the women's liberation movement that has an agenda that is anti-male, it is anti-God, it is a lesbian-oriented, homosexually-oriented agenda, and it will absolutely push its way in unless you decide we will not be culture-driven. Now that, enough of that. But there is individualism, that's where you'll come, and freedom will have gone to seed, but there will be little concept of body. In this, if you let culture drive, then this congregation will be very conscious of members. Each member will be conscious of himself, but instead of there being an awareness of the body welded together through love, you're going to find your members just flopping around bleeding out in the field, all these members flopping and bleeding, but there's no real cohesiveness. This is the we are living in a time when individualism has gone to seed, and we just don't like, we don't like to be ruled over, we don't like to even be bound to. We don't like it. This is one of the hardest times in the world for elders to shepherd flocks. I do not envy any elder who has to shepherd in this time in which we live in, because people just almost say, leave me, I dare you. We were with a church up in Boston, and they just said, just leave me, I dare you. And I told them, I said, you know what? Leading you is about like trying to climb a ladder leaning toward you, or kiss a woman leaning away from you. You just can hardly do it. Will you be culture-driven? I think you need to consider Romans the 12th chapter. As we answer this question, I appeal to you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, 9 through 11, where he just simply says, here are some boundary lines that you've got to accept. Don't you know But the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God. Do not be deceived. Neither the immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor sexual perverts, nor thieves, nor greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor robbers will inherit the kingdom of God. But if you'll notice in there, there are some things that we are selective about. The greedy are listed with the adulterers and the idolaters. And greed is called idolatry. And we'll have to reckon with this whole idea of this, the affluence of a society that has blessed us abundantly. And we're going to have to decide whether or not we will tolerate the disproportionate philosophy that dominates the American scene. Will you be a group of people that shares, and will you be a group of people that attempts to and successfully takes care of the disproportionate distribution that so often plagues the church? And the early church shared what they had. When they found people who were in need, they shared it. We'll have to address that, and I think that's one of our main concerns that we'll have to consider. Will you be tradition-driven? Probably not. Institution-driven? Probably not. Consumer prospect-driven, we're going to be meeting human needs. I think this congregation will. I don't know whether you can escape being want-driven or not. You'll have to make the distinction between, or else you'll become victimized. Then will you be culture-driven, on the broader term, allowing society as a whole to set the standards? There's one other option, and that is to be cross-driven. Will you be cross-driven? And I am convinced that the answer to that has already been given. We are a cross-conscious people. This presents the church as a counterculture. It's different from an institutional-driven church where we all do what it is, whatever it takes to perpetuate the institution and its identity. This is a cross-driven people. We have committed ourselves, and I take it that you've committed yourself to be a cross-formed people. A cruciform people. Now that requires four or five things constituted. The message is Christ, not the church. The cost is death to self. The lifestyle is servanthood. The spirit is humility and love and unity. Those are characteristics. There are probably others that you could mention. But I'm mentioning these because I think these are the basics, the message being the Christ, the cost being death to self, the lifestyle is servanthood, and the spirit is humility. And I mention those because they are things that are not easily swallowed. Making Christ the message is easily, that's easily swallowed. We love to hear about Christ. But when you implement Jesus Christ in our lives, and it comes out as death to self, servanthood and humility, then those pills are sometimes difficult to swallow. Now, the question is, how will the community perceive of you? Will they perceive of you as a Christ-centered, cross-driven or attracted people? And if so, will it come out in these three attributes of death to self, servanthood, and humility? There's one thought that I want to not necessarily conclude with, but I want to get to it, and it's this one. Make no mistake about it, you're going to catch what you bait for. And you can catch any number of people on any one of these options. You can catch people up on the tradition-driven, you can preach a tradition-driven, institutional preservationist message, and you will attract a bushel of people. You can preach a consumer-oriented message that makes every effort to meet not only the needs but the wants of people. And you can do these surveys, and you can take your demographic studies, and you can find out what people want and what they need, and you can have a church that presents 100 different ministries to take care of all these needs of people, from babysitting to whatever it may be, up to bowling. And you know, there's no end to the things that people would be attracted to. You can do that. And I guarantee you'll catch a whole lot of people. And if you go the culture route, you can get a lot of people that will jump on your bandwagon. If you go the Christ-centered route, will you catch anyone? Oh, yes. You know who you'll catch? You'll catch the people who want Jesus Christ. Now, it may not be that simple in the sense that you can differentiate and distinguish and sort it all out, but I'm just simply saying that if you want to catch catfish, guess what you can fish with? Dead liver. It's been in the sun for 2 or 3 days. The louder it stinks, the better. Catfish Charlie. Did you ever fish with Catfish Charlie? You can't get it off your hand. Even after you washed your hand, it's in your dreams if you think that's left you. Your friends will still be avoiding you next week. It just doesn't leave you all that easy. But if you want to catch trout, don't use Catfish Charlie if you want to catch trout. You'll have to figure out the fly or whatever, the minnow or the corn or whatever it is, the trout eggs. If you want to catch trout, you use trout bait. Now, if you want the Church of the Lord to be filled with people who love the Lord, you're going to have to bait them with the Lord. That's all I don't know of anything else. That's so common sense, I don't know how else to say it. You're going to catch what you bait for. And I know we have baited in the years past, we have baited with intellectual syllogisms and all these little gimmicks and things that we have teased people's intellect, and we've baited for that. And guess what? We've caught them. The church was filled and is filled. We've got a lot of us who were attracted by that kind of bait. And some of the people who are most offended with just preaching a message of Christ are those people who had held out before them the perfect church and they thought they were getting in it. And then you come and tell them Jesus Christ is the bait and that this perfect church has some warts and blemishes on it, and they're most highly offended. Because the bait that they bit, you're now switching the bait, and they don't like that. But I'm just wanting to urge us, decide who it is that you want to catch. You want to catch the people who know they're lost, but you want to catch the people who have a heart for God. I want to read something, and I don't quite understand how it all fits in, but I want to read from the intrusive word. This is a book by a William Willimon, and Rubel and I have talked about it. I'm not quite sure where it fits in. The man is a liberal. He is an admitted liberal. But my goodness, listen to what he says. The gospel is not a set of interesting ideas about which we are supposed to make up our minds. The gospel is intrusive news that evokes a new set of practices, a complex of habits, a way of living in the world, discipleship. Because of its epistemological uniqueness, we cannot merely map the gospel onto our present experiences. The gospel is not an archaic, peculiar way of naming our particular, typical human experiences through certain religious expressions. The gospel means to engender, to evoke, a peculiar experience that we would not have had before we met the gospel. He's saying that the gospel is something that is unique, that you cannot just map it down on your present experiences, but that it is a message from outside that comes to you and calls for a response in you that you would not have had before you met the gospel. Listen again. Christianity is not a description of life that everyone can understand if they just take the trouble to think it out clearly. Paul Tillich was wrong in this. The offense of the gospel is more than just in the word God. It is that God is the Trinity, and by that he identifies it with the Jewish Christian God, Yahweh. It is that Jesus Christ is Lord. Calling God ultimate reality, as Tillich did, is a vain attempt to sidestep the political power claim being made in biblical speech. The doctrine of original sin is not the only empirically verifiable, or yes, verifiable doctrine in Christianity, self-evident to any person who knows a little Western history. Sin is not a mistake we make. Sin is rebellion against the Trinity. Christianity, we believe, is not a story we have chosen, something about which we have decided. It chose us. We have been embraced by this story from outside of our limited experiences. This is an external word, according to Luther, that someone had to speak to us. Faith comes by what is heard, said Paul in Romans 10, in order for us to discover it. So in a sense, we don't discover the gospel. It discovers us. You did not choose me, but I chose you, Jesus said. Now, I'm not sure where all that fits in, and I'm not ashamed to admit that I don't quite know yet how to preach to the unbaptized. I've been trying for 25 years, but what I need to find out is what kind of people is God calling to himself, and what are we to use as bait? What does this church want to be? And the simple premise, you're going to catch what you bait for. And this church, 10 years from now, will be filled with the people that you've baited, and it's not my place to do anything beyond what Rubel said to begin this seminar. It's Christ, no more and no less. And if we preach Christ in his fullness, no more and no less, and don't hide him and preach just the part that's appealing and then let the other shoe drop once we get them in the fold, and often that's done. We mustn't do that. We have no right to do that. We don't switch baits. We don't bait and then switch. I want to read one verse out of one reading out of 1 Corinthians, and you're familiar with this, and I'll let this be our close for the evening. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, their wants. Greeks seek wisdom, their likes, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. And you know, he said that in the face of the ones who were wanting something else. He said, we've just made a decision. We decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. If I had one prayer for this congregation, it would be that, not only in proclamation, but in application, not only in word, but in deed. If you can go down in history as a cross-formed people. It won't set well with everybody. But since when did the gospel ever set well with everybody? We're trying to please him, and the people who want to please him will hear his message. And the people of God who have formed around Jesus Christ will not be offended when you tell them what Jesus Christ expects of them. May God bless us. I thank you for letting me be with you this weekend. Thank you.